So here's to all of the good thinkers, and here's to the lonely drinker. But don't you know, let this moment pass.
Hello, folks. My name is Jason Spies, and I'm an award-winning multimedia journalist and then the host of the Crude Life Media Network and podcast. Thank you, folks, for tuning in to The Crude Life, a place for expert interviews, full-length features, and specialty programs. And it is all thanks to our fine sponsors. Be loyal to our sponsors. They keep the program free and literally keep our lights on.
So here's to watching the clocks of our grandfathers, and here's to stopping and picking flowers, and here's to not letting this moment pass you by.
Yeah, this is Nick Flom, the executive director for the Northern Plains UAS test site.
Northern Plains UAS test site. Some people might not be familiar with what that is exactly. How do you describe that test site and the UAS drone industry?
Yeah, so the FAA designated six test sites to do testing of unmanned aircraft to help integrate them so that they can fly, you know, side by side with manned airplanes safely.
By the way, how's that going? We are one of six test states, and that's kind of actually a pretty important thing to realize. What are you guys doing, I guess, in terms of for being a test state? What are some of the things that you guys are testing?
Yeah, sure. So some of the things that we're looking at, you know, for example, are ways of expanding the sets of rules. Back in August, we had the FAA released a small UAS rule allowing for flights of aircraft weighing under 55 pounds that can fly up to 400 feet as long as you keep it in sight. That was a great movement forward for our industry. And, you know, we're looking at, we're doing testing of, like, night operations. Right now that's a limitation. You can't fly UAS at night. So we're, you know, giving them the FAA data so that, you know, everyone can start safely flying at night, maybe even at higher altitudes.
Are we talking about these big, giant drones that the military uses, or are we talking about ones that you can go to, you know, Verizon store and buy, or both?
It's absolutely both. You know, the current set of rules that the FAA has in place are the latter, what you talked about, the small, you know, UAS that you can, you know, potentially buy off of Amazon. But we're also doing testing of, you know, larger platforms. We've been running a series of tests this summer using an airplane that's probably the equivalent of a four-passenger, you know, small general aviation aircraft, and doing image analysis of farm fields and also infrastructure for the utility industry.
Which leads me to my next question, energy integration. How involved are you with sort of in energy integration, whether it be a UAV, UAS, or a drone, maybe monitoring some power lines or maybe a pipeline? Are you involved much with an energy integration?
Yeah, we are. And that's, I actually have some operations that will be taking place next week that's assessing from a utility electric company. Damage assessment, you know, post-storm disaster. You know, is this something that we can send a UAS to actually, you know, determine the change if there's a down power line? These types of technologies can be transferred over to the pipeline inspections. You know, that's, a lot of that's currently being done by manned aircraft. Anytime that I can, you know, do something that's, you know, dull, dirty, or dangerous, which flying a manned airplane at low altitudes for like a pipeline inspection, you know, follows, you know, not necessarily the dirty part, but the, you know, dull and dangerous. You know, those are areas that we're looking into making a lot more efficient.
How about when it comes to precision agriculture? How involved are you with some of the, I don't know if they're experiments or they're projects or testing, but some of the things that are going on with the precision agriculture here in the state?
You know, we're directly involved with probably most of the efforts that are involved with precision agriculture in the state of North Dakota. And we're looking at that stuff from really interesting tests, high altitude. where we can capture 25,000 acres per hour with a large UAS, taking wide swaths of imagery. And then we follow up and fly a small UAS at lower altitudes that definitely can't cover the same amount of ground. And then following that up with, you know, ground truthing, you know, actually walking the fields and doing sand counts and kind of getting an idea, you know, can I fly a large UAS at high altitudes? Does that give me the same type of resolution that can, you know, help a farmer make those, you know, critical decisions that, you know, are traditionally done maybe with satellite, being done with maybe a small UAS? So we're looking at the analysis of all of that right now.
So I've been covering the UAS industry for since about 2007. Tommy Kenville, who I'm very confident you're familiar with, being up there in Grand Forks. I used to have him on my radio program back in like 2007, 2008. People thought we were crazy. We should be on the overnight coast-to-coast conspiracy radio because we were talking about drones the size of honeybees, because that's what they had back then, at least over in Israel they did. I mean, Israel is a big progressive when it comes to the UAS technology, and so, you know, we've learned a lot from them. The thing that I used to always bring up to Commissioner Doug Goring, Ag Commissioner Goring in North Dakota, was that at some day we're going to be at a point where a drone will fly over a row of sunflowers or a row of potatoes or whatever, and it will be able to identify the individual disease or pathogen on a specific plant, and it will send a little relay to a drone four-wheeler. Probably the size of an old toy car or something like that, that's got a pesticide that'll just mist that one specific area, which is going to be incredible savings and efficiencies. And Goring has mentioned or has said that that's the direction they're going. Do you see that as well? Is that the direction we're going? And how close are we to getting to that final point, I guess?
You know, that is, you know, everything that you mentioned, I mean, that is the absolute end goal of all of this. You know, the anytime that we're analyzing the data or we're giving the data to a decision maker, the farmer, whoever it happens to be, it has to be so precise. It has to be informative enough that they don't have to go through, you know, pages and pages of analysis to determine, hey, I need to go spray this one area. So, you know, things that we're working on with the different types of cameras that we're putting on the airplane is exactly what you're talking about. You know, how do we start to get some of the different signatures off of these diseases so that we can actually identify, you know, different diseases? That's being done so that we can put together this full catalog, you know, for the imagery analysis. The second part of that is, you know, how we're talking, you know, gigabytes, if not terabytes, of information. How do I get that information down quickly so that we can start making as close to real-time decisions as possible? The big data analysis, that is another challenge that we're working through. Yamaha has been flying in Japan with an aircraft over the rice paddy field with a UAS, spraying exactly the way you talked about it with a, you know, maybe a driverless car or something along those lines. I mean, my ideal is that exactly what you're talking about, except for the, instead of the driverless tractor, I have a, you know, a driverless, you know, a UAS that's going to spray that one spot. You know, we're definitely not quite there yet. Still doing a lot of tests, but, you know, every single test that we come down with, I feel like we're progressing, you know, one step closer to that reality.
And a lot of that came clear to me. I interviewed John Nowotsky from NDSU, who's very much one of the principal UAS individuals there with the precision agriculture, what they have that going on in Hillsboro. And the data part was what he really opened my eyes to, is when you're talking about moving that amount of data with the speeds that we have in place, it's going to probably take one more generation of technology to make it become more real time. When I think about it, kind of like how we went from, you know, Cat 5 wires to T1 wires to fiber optics and, you know, these types of things. Do you see what I mean? Do you see where we're going to have to go to that next level because of the different file sizes?
You know, it's, you know, working with especially John on those projects, you know, we've been supporting him on all of those flight operations. We've been the arm that's conducted the flight ops. You know, the things that I'm seeing is, you know, it's to get the information down, but it's to get it analyzed, you know, that one step quicker. So that, you know, is there a way of, you know, sparsing the information so I don't have to take down, you know, relevant data? I absolutely agree. We're not quite there yet. That's, you know, the big data push is, you know, that is evolving just as quick as the UAS industry right now on how to support that type of stuff. We're probably not quite there yet. It does not necessarily make sense to have, you know, every farmer who needs to analyze this stuff have a server, you know, at their house in order to support this type of information. That's just not a scalable or realistic, you know, proposition. Unfortunately, right now, that's, you know, the best case scenario. But, you know, I think everyone's moving to move the data side, you know, just that much quicker to be able to process it and give real-time information.
That's incredible visual, and that really does kind of explain where we're at in the, you know, the curve of this technology to where, you know, if you think about the old bag phones and some of the trunk phones and that sort of thing, that's kind of where we're at. I mean, if we're talking about you might need a server in your barn in order to do something like this at this point, that's kind of where I see things. But the thing about technology is when these advancements happen, they happen very quickly, and the marketplace seems to adapt very quickly to technology like nothing has ever happened in the marketplace before. Let me ask you about the colleges, NDSU, UND, and you can even throw Wahpeton in there if you want. There is quite a spine of UAS development here on the eastern side of North Dakota. When you look at I believe they're manufacturing them down in Wahpeton, and then you have NDSU, which essentially is creating the code and the analytics, and it's kind of the brain behind a lot of the different things. And then up at UND, you've got, you know, you have the park there as well as the training of a lot of the people who are going to be manning these different vehicles. Just your comments on the relationships with North Dakota State education system with the UAS.
You know, I think that a big pusher behind this is you have, you know, the chancellor of the North Dakota University system who is recognizing the importance of UAS. And on top of that, you know, the big data side that's going to correspond with that. And we're seeing, you know, especially from the test site standpoint, I get the opportunity to work with all of these different groups. And I get to, you know, from a synergistic standpoint, I can take, you know, the flight operations experience that has been so strong at the University of North Dakota and leverage that against, you know, the research elements from the land-grant college with precision agriculture down at North Dakota State University. And, you know, we're working together on this stuff. We've created this cluster of to support each other instead of compete against each other. And we're moving, you know, down the path just that much quicker in that collaborative standpoint. And that is, it's helping from, you know, the chancellor from the top who's recognizing that this is important for all these universities to be involved with.
How about when it comes to the economic development side of things? You know, I covered the oil industry for the last 5 years pretty extensively. I still do programs out there in the oil industry as well. Write for the Bismarck Tribune, a weekly column for the Bakken Weekly. The oil industry has quite a bit of economic development. I mean, from every rig you have, probably 1,000 jobs that are created off of that one rig. When you talk about the pipeline companies and you talk about the wrench companies and the analytics companies, the fracking sand companies, it goes on and on and on and on. What are you seeing in the UAS industry in terms of outside of precision agriculture? Because really right now, precision agriculture is really taking up most of the UAS market share. But I see surveillance, I see energy integration. What other economic development areas are you seeing? Are you seeing some on the manufacturing side, the software side? Just talk to me about the economic development of this particular industry.
You know, it's funny that it's the unmanned, you know, aircraft system, and there's absolutely nothing unmanned about it. You know, the number of jobs that are supported with, you know, each element that you're talking about. You know, from a pilot crew standpoint, you know, there's we have service providers across the state that are creating jobs to, you know, if you want to go by the fly, you know, you want to have somebody, instead of owning your aircraft, you're going to have a service provider out there who's going to support you. you know, that the job creation with that has been, you know, we're starting to see that grow with, you know, small companies who are, you know, now employing, you know, a dozen plus operators. That's just going to continue to start to grow. Some of the other elements, like what you mentioned, you know, you have the manufacturing side of the UAS. On top of that, the UAS is just the one element. We also have the sensor, the payloads, the cameras that are going on board the aircraft. That's a market that we have some existing companies within North Dakota that have been working on that, you know, for, you know, 5+ years. But now the fact that we have a commercial market for these UAS, we're going to start to see a lot more, I think, of those types of technology companies starting to grow. If it's a, you know, Field of View in Grand Forks that has been, you know, traditionally doing a lot of these sensor payloads, or you have a technology avionics company like Apario down in Fargo that has been involved with the aviation industry. Are those companies going to expand into the UAS market and grow their businesses that way, or are we going to start to see new businesses, you know, to support some of these technologies coming down the line? Data hubs, you know, that's a big area that, you know, the state of North Dakota is very interested in. That's going to be creating, you know, lots of new jobs just to support what we just got done talking about, the data analytics side. There's companies, you know, that are starting to set up their roots in North Dakota because they see this coming. And, you know, it might just be, you know, a dozen guys right now, but, you know, we're looking to turn those into hundreds of jobs.
All right. And final question, I guess. We'll just kind of wrap up here. Talking with Nick Flom, executive director for the – what is the name of the actual organization? Is it North – go ahead.
Northern Plains UAS test site.
Plains, that's what I got snagged up here. I didn't have it written down, and I was trying to go off memory quick, and I got snagged on Northern Plains. But congratulations on your new position. You're replacing Robert Beckland, who did a fantastic job there. Just kind of some comments on what you're walking into and what you see your organization now going under your direction.
Yeah, you know, I had the privilege of being Bob Beckland's first hire in the test site going back, you know, almost 3 years ago now when we were first stood up. And, you know, got to watch the direction we started, you know, really with, at that time, you know, the FAA kind of scratching their heads on, you know, where is this going? We didn't even have a set of rules or even a way for any type of commercial operations for UAS. You know, since that time, we've had our little bit of a patchwork with the Section 333s that, you know, started to slowly get some commercial operations going within the state, and that is now expanded into a full-blown set of regulations for small UAS. We helped drive a lot of those initial developments with the FAA on some of, you know, our different requests that we've had from the FAA, with the data that we've been able to produce back to them. On top of that, now I think we're looking at, you know, taking that another step, you know, how are we going to get support, you know, areas like, you know, Grand Sky Business Park that, you know, is looking potentially for, you know, larger aircraft, the General Atomics or Northrop Grumman, you know, these aircraft that fly more traditionally like manned aircraft. We have a lot of big initiatives to support those type of customers and, you know, integrate them into the airspace, you know, safely and efficiently. You know, we're going to just, you know, continue to pay the path forward. You know, there's still a lot of work to be done to integrate, you know, UAS into the airspace, you know, with manned traffic. But we'll just keep pushing along. And, you know, we have great state support from that. And we have a lot of the baseline there. We have the university systems that are working, you know, these issues. And we have initiatives from the state like, you know, Grand Sky Business Park where, you know, first of its kind area that is devoted to, you know, supporting this industry. You know, from my standpoint, it's we've got a lot of momentum moving forward. I don't look to, you know, get us off track on that, and you know, just keep building on what we have for the last, you know, really from the UAS side, you know, almost decade here in North Dakota.
And here's to the sound of one hand clapping. And here's to not letting this moment pass. And here's to carrying the weight of the world. And here's to screaming, yeah, never being heard. And here's to not letting this moment pass.
My name is Otis, and I am the host of the Kids in Capitalism KidCast. Let me tell you about one of our sponsors. Hatch Realty is in the business of helping people. They just happen to sell real estate. Call Eric Hatch or anyone on the Hatch Realty team with any real estate question. They want to be a resource and connection for you. That's Hatch Realty, 701-212-1572. That's 701-212-1572. Hatch Realty in the business of helping people. They just happen to sell real estate. Hatch Realty, tell them Otis sent you.
Since 1979, MBI Energy Services has committed to responsibly growing with today's oil and gas industry by providing proven experience, strategic locations, and integrated services. MBI Energy Services is well established, and its innovation in safety and excellent customer service is what truly makes MBI Energy Services the oil field service professionals. MBI Energy Services, the cutting edge in oil field safety solutions. Learn more at MBIEnergyServices.com.
Oil and gas industry is coming back, and you need a source to keep up to date on the industry. Check out Oil Man, the magazine for leaders in the American energy industry. Each issue gives you a competitive edge with the latest oil and gas news. In addition to the news and analysis, the Oil Man brings you exciting features, publishes photos from yesteryear that chronicle the history of the oil and gas industry. Visit oilman.com to learn more and subscribe today. That's theoilman.com.